This meeting of the Senate Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:30 p.m. Monday, February 25th, 2019. Present are Vice Chair Coghill, Senator Giesel, Senator Bishop, Senator Reinbold, Senator Keel, Senator Kawasaki, and myself, Chairman Birch. And I don't see any legislators in the office. I would ask that you silence your cell phones. And I would note that we only have one item on today's agenda. That would be SGR 7, endorsing Anwar Leasing. Anwar is certainly critical to the future economy of our state and for increasing TAPS throughput. It's interesting, as we look at this, Senator Giesel has provided a summary of the 14 prior times that this body has collectively generated a resolution, and it's certainly been a long-term effort on the part of this body. Obviously, Anwar and the development potential has an opportunity to create thousands of jobs for Alaskan and bring in billions in revenue for state coffers. We'd like to see progress made on Anwar Leasing's program and show that Alaska is indeed open for business. And the resolution will serve as the 31st legislature's comment on the draft environmental impact statement. And I did want to note that we would like to get that done. Was it March 13th? Is the closing date for public testimony. So there's interest in moving this. But with that, we're joined today by Trevor Fulton, our committee aide, and Trevor is going to walk us through the resolution. Trevor?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Trevor Fulton, Senate Resources Committee aide and staff to Senator Birch. In late 2017, after nearly 40 years of effort by the state and by Alaska's federal delegation, Congress finally authorized an oil and gas leasing program for Anwar with the passage of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. That congressional authorization of Anwar activity is what makes this resolution differ from the many previous versions you've likely seen over the years, as evidenced in the spreadsheet sitting at your desks. Rather than urging Congress to open up Anwar, the version before you today urges the executive branch, specifically the Department of the Interior, to stay the course on a leasing program. A leasing program which has just taken an important early step in the regulatory process with the publication of a draft environmental impact statement just this December. That's what's different about this version of the Anwar resolution. However, much of the rest remains the same. The whereases of this resolution continue to focus on the impressive oil and gas potential of Anwar, which is estimated at 7.7 billion barrels of oil and 7 trillion cubic feet of gas. The potential benefits of Anwar could bring to Alaska and the rest of the country, including generating over $100 billion in state, federal, and local government revenues, creating over 12,500 direct and indirect jobs at peak employment, increasing throughput and extending the life of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, and enhancing the economics of the AK LNG project, all while strengthening national security, bolstering the U.S. economy, and providing affordable energy to U.S. consumers. The resolution also highlights advances in oil field technology that have exponentially shrunk in development footprints over the years. It highlights a 50-year record of safe and responsible development on the North Slope and the continued state commitment to ensuring the health of the porcupine and central Arctic caribou herds and protecting the environment and wildlife of Alaska's Arctic region. And finally, it also highlights the widespread support for responsible development in the Anwar Coastal Plain by Alaskans in general, and specifically by residents of the North Slope. My final note, Mr. Chairman, as you already pointed out, is that one of the goals of this resolution is to serve as the 31st Legislature's official comment on the BLM's 2018 Coastal Plain Oil and Gas Leasing Program Draft Environmental Impact Statement, which was published in December. Comments submitted on the draft EIS will inform key decisions to be made in the final EIS, which is scheduled for release later this year. Those key decisions include which areas of the coastal plain would be offered for leasing, as well as the terms and conditions to be applied to those leases. In order for this resolution to provide meaningful input on the draft EIS, this resolution will have to make it through both bodies before that March 13th deadline. That concludes my remarks, Mr. Chairman. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Fulton. Are there questions of the from the committee? Seeing none. Oh, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fulton, my email has started to light up in the last day or so with this hearing scheduled. A couple of questions. Maybe you can help me answer some of what's coming to me. As you talk about a potential revenue source of $100 billion to an array of governments, do you have a rough proportion of how that benefit gets split out? Uncle Sam, Auntie State, Mr. Muni, what, even thirds, who gets what?
Thank you for the question, Senator Keel, through the chair. that information is actually available in the draft EIS on the BLM's website. I didn't provide members with a copy of the entire draft document because it's over 700 pages. I did give you about a 10-page executive summary. Unfortunately, this information isn't in there. Otherwise, I'd point you directly to it. But if you're taking notes, that can actually be found in Section 3, page 236. North Slope Borough would stand to, and this is, keep in mind, this is over about a 30-year period. This is projected out until 2050. Looking at $1.2 billion to local governments, $71 billion to the state government, and $32.5 billion to the federal government over that 30-year period.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. I also want to note that we have Faith Martineau from the Department of Natural Resources Office of Project Management and Permitting online and available for questions, if there are any questions of her as well. Other questions from the committee member?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thanks. Just a couple questions on the whereases. In the, I guess it'd be the fourth whereas, it talks about the two lease sales held by December 2024. In the law, I think it refers to a 10-year after date of enactment. So is that a mistype or is that a...
I'm not actually familiar with that clause. I might have to punt that one to Faith Martineau at DNR.
Okay. And then I've got a handful of others, just technical things.
Would you like to have that one answered first?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. Hello, Ms. Martineau, are you online?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair.
Would you care to field the question from Senator Kawasaki, or would you like him to repeat the question?
Mr. Chair, if I could ask the senator to repeat the question, I may be able to be of assistance.
Sure. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the law itself, it calls for a 10-year after enactment of the law. So wouldn't 10 years be closer to 2028? I'm just trying to make sure the form's correct first.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, the Section 20001 of the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act does refer to or provide specific direction to the Department of Interior and Bureau of Land Management to conduct not fewer than two lease sales within 10 years. However, the first lease sale has to be enacted within 4 years of the issue of the finalization of that tax act. And so that would be 2022.
Oh, okay.
Because it was passed in 2017.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
Yes, thanks.
Any other questions?
I do have
a follow-up.
Yeah, not a follow-up, just another question on the fifth whereas talks about an estimated 7.7 billion barrels of oil and then 7 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, and I just wondered where the source came from for that.
Through the chair, thank you for the question, Senator Kawasaki. Again, that came from the draft EIS document itself. And while you can't find it in that executive summary, you can find it on page 36 of Section 3. And the source that they're quoting within that document is a USGS report from 2005.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fulton, the other thing in the resolution that I've gotten some questions about is the 2,000 acres of potential disturbance. and a drill pad is pretty easy to calculate the acreage on. But I've sort of heard different understandings from folks about how you calculate all of the acreage, right? I mean, you got a 17-foot wide roadbed runs a mile. It's only 2.5 acres, but it's a mile of interaction there on the tundra. How does that work? Did Congress set limits, or does the federal government have rules about how that's calculated?
Senator Keel, thank you for the question through the chair. They do actually put some parameters on that in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. It's pretty minimal. I'll go ahead and read you that section real briefly, and then there's a little more information that can be found in the in the draft environmental impact statement as well. So in the law itself, Public Law 115-97, it speaks about surface development and that 2,000-acre limitation you mentioned. And verbatim, it reads, in administering this section, the Secretary shall authorize up to 2,000 surface acres of federal land on the coastal plain to be covered by production and support facilities. And then in parentheses, it says, including airstrips in any area covered by gravel berms or piers for support of pipelines during the term of the leases under the oil and gas program under this section. So that's what the law itself prescribed. And then when they were engaged in the scoping process for the EIS document, the draft EIS document, there were a number of public comments wanting a little more information than that. So in the draft EIS, they go on to, if you'll allow me to read, Mr. Chairman, the BLM interprets the types of production and support facilities that will count towards the 2,000-acre limit as including any type of gravel or other fill-constructed facility which touches the land surface, to include gravel pads used for processing facilities, including wells, production facilities, or pump or compressor stations, gravel airstrips or roads, which I think goes to the heart of your question, and any other area covered by gravel berms or piers for support of pipelines. All of that would fall under the 2,000-acre limitation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Bishop.
I yield. Thank you. Trevor covered it. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Any other questions? Well, seeing no additional questions, we would like to open public testimony. And we will begin with invited testimony. I'd ask invited testifiers to begin with their prepared remarks before taking committee questions. I believe up first we have Faith Martineau, again, from DNR, Office of Project Management and Permitting. And in general, we would like to keep testimony in the 3-minute range if that works for everybody. Ms. Martineau?
Thank you, Chairman Birch, and committee members for the opportunity to testify. Again, for the record, my name is Faith Martineau, and I am the Executive Director for the Office of Project Management and Permitting in the Department of Natural Resources. I also lead the State of Alaska's participation as a cooperating agency in the development of an Environmental Impact Statement, or EIS, for an oil and gas leasing program in the Coastal Plain. I'm calling today to voice DNR's support for Senate Joint Resolution Number 7, which requests that the Department of Interior Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, implement an oil and gas leasing program in the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The long-debated question of whether oil and gas activity should take place within the coastal plain, which consists of the non-wilderness portion of the refuge, really was settled with passage of the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which I'll refer to again as the Tax Act. The question with which we are now faced is really how such activities should occur. The Department of Interior and BLM have taken the first steps toward implementation of an oil and gas leasing program in the coastal plain by initiating development of an EIS. And throughout the federal process, the state has contributed resources to help BLM assess the potential indirect impacts associated with the leasing program and also to establish foundations for a scientifically driven permitting process for future oil and gas related activities. The state's cooperating agency team includes representatives from the divisions within DNR, as well as Department of Fish and Game and Department of Environmental Conservation. The core team has also been assisted by the Department of Health and Social Services, Department of Law, and also the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. BLM, as you know, recently published the draft EIS, which reflects a suite of potential implementation strategies. These alternatives describe the areas that would be available for oil and gas leasing, as well as the potential accompanying lease stipulations, which is particularly important. The state's cooperating agency team has reviewed and provided comments on the draft EIS, which will be submitted to BLM as a single consolidated letter representing the state's collective interest and expertise. From DNR's perspective, it's really critical that BLM develop and select an alternative that provides the maximum level of flexibility to future decision makers, which would enable them to rely on new information, such as exploratory seismic data, and on the existing local, state, and federal permitting processes to facilitate responsible development, production, and transportation of oil and gas resources to and from the coastal plain. DNR has specifically reached out to the North Slope Borough and to other organizations that represent resident stakeholders to identify some areas of potential alignment and possible partnership. We've had several productive conversations to date about the alternatives presented in the draft EIS, and we'll continue that dialogue as we approach the March 13th deadline for submitting comments to BLM. I personally believe that SJR number 7 will reinforce the importance of responsible oil and gas development to the state and to all Alaskans, and hope that the final resolution includes a recommendation from the Alaska legislature to maximize flexibility for future decision makers as BLM determines how to implement an oil and gas leasing program in the coastal plain. I appreciate the opportunity to comment and stand available for any questions that the committee may have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. I'll see if there's any committee questions. Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thanks, Ms. Martineau, for being online. You mentioned that DNR, in conjunction with Fish and Game and DEC, were involved or are the party on behalf of the state. Can you just tell me sort of the process that each of those agencies has gone through to sort of flesh out the EIS?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, absolutely. So the state of Alaska, you know, as you know, has a lot of different departments and divisions and programs, each with its own mission and responsibilities. To maximize the kind of efficiency and effectiveness of the state's commenting opportunities, especially during federal plans reviews, such as with the Coastal Plain Oil and Gas Leasing Program, EIS, the Office of Project Management and Permitting coordinates directly with the agency representatives to collect comments. And so this coordinated approach helps to ensure that the state has a subject matter expert for each of the different resource areas. And so in the case of the Coastal Plain Oil and Gas Leasing Program, EIS, the Department of Fish and Game has specifically identified data and including studies based on monitoring for terrestrial mammals, including caribou. The Department of Environmental Conservation was key in identifying existing monitoring information related to air quality and also to provide comments regarding spill response. And the Department of Natural Resources has been able to identify potential solutions regarding water sources and the lack of abundant surface water within the coastal plain area. There's a number of other resource areas where the state has provided comments, but those are some key examples.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That concludes. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony this afternoon, Ms. Martineau. Next, we have in the queue Carl Portman with the Resource Development Council of Alaska. Carl?
Good afternoon. I'm Carl Portman. I'm the Deputy Director of the Resource Development Council, and I am here today to speak in support of SJR 7, requesting implementation of an oil and gas leasing program on the coastal plain. RDC has consistently supported opening the 1002 area to oil and gas development. The coastal plain is considered America's best onshore prospect for conventional oil and gas discoveries. At a recent public hearing in Anchorage in Washington, D.C., RDC expressed support for the proposed oil and gas leasing program that would allow limited activity within the non-federal portion of the coastal plain. BLM has made a good effort in a well-organized DEIS to be responsive to the congressional directive opening the 1002 area to oil and gas leasing. Alaska depends on the responsible development of its natural resources to support its economy. In fact, it wasn't until the discovery of oil that led Congress to finally vote in favor of Alaska's statehood. Through the discovery of oil, Congress realized Alaska could have a healthy economy through the development of its natural resources. Alaska's North Slope has now produced more than 17 billion barrels of oil. oil production has been the economic engine of growth in Alaska. Even though the Trans-Alaska Pipeline is running at one quarter capacity, oil production generated $2.7 billion in state revenues in FY2018, accounting for approximately 80% of unrestricted general fund revenues. Were oil production occurring today on the coastal plain, our economic lifeline could be operating at two-thirds capacity or more, sharply reducing Alaska's budget deficit and helping sustain public services Alaskans depend upon. The oil industry has demonstrated over the past 40 years that North Slope energy development and environmental stewardship can and do coexist. The industry has a proven track record of responsible development in sensitive areas, protecting the environment, wildlife, and subsistence needs of local residents. Federal law requires the footprint of production and support facilities to be limited to no more than 2,000 surface acres of the 1.6 million acre 1002 area, which is the non-wilderness portion of the refuge's coastal plain. That is equivalent to just 0.01% of ANWR's 19 million acres. I'd like to point out also there are special interests in our nation that are opposed to perfect development of America's energy resources. They do advocate leaving oil in the ground, but reality requires continued development of America's oil and gas resources. New oil and gas production will be required to power America's economy and can serve as the bridge to the renewable and the green energy sources of the future. Moreover, every barrel of oil not developed in Alaska will simply be imported from overseas, where environmental regulations are often weaker and the footprint, carbon footprint is larger. In conclusion, responsible oil and gas development in a small fraction of the coastal plain proposed for leasing will help Alaska realize the benefits that come from energy production in the 1002 area. In addition to the many public services funded across Alaska by oil revenues, North Slope production generates thousands of jobs. On the North Slope and elsewhere, the industry and the jobs it provides has generated an economy, raised the standard of living, and has significantly improved the quality of life. Jobs enable self-sufficiency, raises one's confidence and self-esteem, and provides a means to support a family. The power of a job transforms lives and breaks the cycle of dependency. This is a major benefit of energy development in Alaska, and the 1002 area is no exception.
Thank you, Mr. Portman.
Thank you for the opportunity to comment, and we urge you to pass SJR 7.
Thank you, Mr. Portman. Let's see if there are any committee questions. Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony this afternoon. Next, you have Kara Moriarty with the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Oh, we sure can, loud and clear.
All right. Well, thank you very much. As I said, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kara Moriarty, and I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, commonly referred to as AOGA. AOGA is the professional trade association for the oil and gas industry, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify today on Senate Joint Resolution 7, which, as we've heard, endorses a leasing program for the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, commonly referred to as ANWR. Like most Alaskans, the oil and gas industry has long supported a leasing program for the coastal plain. The support for development has remained strong for decades, and just this past January, a statewide poll showed that 64% of Alaskans continue to support development in this region. That is over two-thirds of Alaskans. It's hard to get two-thirds of Alaskans to agree to much. The Arctic National Refuge was formed shortly after statehood in 1960 with 9 million acres and was expanded to over 19 million acres with the passage of ANILCA in 1980, with over 90% of the region permanently protected as wilderness. However, there is a section of ANILCA, and the number of the section is 1002, which now stands for the 1002 area, and that section of the law stated that a small portion of the coastal plain would be set aside for future oil and gas development. And how small? We've heard talk already today about the 2,000 acres that would be limited to. And to give you reference, that's about the size of the ranch I grew up on in South Dakota, but as an example that may be more relevant to those of us who travel, the Dulles International Airport is about 12,000 acres. The Baltimore International Airport, BWI, is just under 3,600 acres. And right here in Anchorage, our own Ted Stevens International Airport is 4,608 acres. So why are we even discussing more oil and gas development? The U.S. Energy Information Administration predicts that by 2050, petroleum and other liquids, followed closely by natural gas, will remain by multiple magnitudes the most consumed energy source in the United States, and the International Energy Administration has a similar prediction for global demand. So if the demand for oil and gas is still going to be there at least 30 years from now, why the coastal plain? Well, in different studies that have been conducted over the years, the government has described the potential 10 to 11 billion barrels of oil recovery from the 1002 area as the most significant oil potential in the United States. It is the largest onshore play in federal land in the entire country. Production from the coastal plain will reduce our reliance on foreign oil over the decades, and the EIA predicts that from 2031 to 2050, production from the coastal plain will reduce U.S. expenditures on crude oil and petroleum product imports by almost $600 billion.
Thank you.
We have, as the industry, we have a history of safe, effective, and environmentally responsible development of the Arctic spanning almost five decades. Development today does not occur the same as it did 40 years ago. Our typical oil pad has gone from 65 acres in 1970 with a drilling area underground of extending of about 3 miles to today with the advancement of a new drilling rig by Doyon, an Alaska Native corporation. Extended reach drilling will expand almost 150 miles underground with a total gravel pad of 12 acres on the surface.
Thank you.
So we believe that development of the coastal plain will be good for the country and will continue to build upon the jobs and revenues the industry has contributed to the state for decades.
Thank you, Ms. Moriarty. Are you?
To testify.
Oh, yeah, I just was going to ask if you had any concluding remarks.
Nope, that's it. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much for your testimony this afternoon, Ms. Moriarty. Let me see if there's any committee questions. Seeing none, thanks again for your testimony. Next this afternoon, we have Albert Fogle with the Alaska Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Fogle.
Thank you, Chairman, and the committee members. My name is Albert Fogle, and I am the Vice President for the Alaska Chamber, which is a nonprofit organization founded to promote a positive business environment in Alaska. We are the leading voice for small and large business representing hundreds of employers and local chambers across Alaska. I can't express our strong support for Senate Joint Resolution 7, which emphasizes the legislature's support and continuation of allowing limited oil and gas activity within the non-wilderness coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Responsible oil and gas development in the small fraction of ANWR proposed for leasing will help ensure America's energy security for decades and Alaska and our nation as a whole to realize the benefits that come from expanding energy production in Alaska. Energy production from the non-wilderness coastal plain has the potential to offset a decline in lower 48 oil production, shale oil production, which is expected to commence in approximately a decade. Without limited oil development on the coastal plain, America will be forced to once again increase its reliance on foreign imports. With limited development in ANWR, America and Alaska can continue to grow the economy and reduce dependence on foreign oil. Alaska's economic lifeline, Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, is now running at three-quarters empty. New oil production from the coastal plain has the potential to reverse throughput in TAPS, a vital component of American energy infrastructure. Oil development on a fraction of the coastal plain would create thousands of jobs nationwide and in Alaska, generate billions of dollars in government revenue for public services, keep energy prices for Americans and Alaskans affordable, and further improve energy security for the future. Thanks to continuing improvements in technology, practices, and oversight, the oil industry has demonstrated over the past 40 years that North Slope energy development and environmental stewardship can and do exist. The industry has a proven track record of responsible development in sensitive areas, protecting the environment, wildlife, and subsistence needs of local residents. Advances in technology have greatly reduced the footprint of a development in the Arctic. As much as a 60-plus square miles can now be developed from a single 12 to 14-acre gravel drill site. New drilling capabilities are being developed that may increase the subsurface development possible from the same drilling size site to as much as 150-plus square miles. The net effect is an ever-decreasing impact on surface resources. The coastal plain was specifically identified by Congress pursuant to the Section 1102 of ANOCA for the potential for oil and natural gas resources. Oil and gas from the non-wilderness portion of the coastal plain is an important resource for meeting our nation's energy demands and achieving energy dominance.
Thank you, Mr. Fogel.
We again support SJR 7 and encourage it to pass. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Fogel, for your testimony this afternoon. We'll see if there's any questions from the committee. I see none. Thanks again. At this point, we'll move on to additional public testimony beginning in the room here. If we have anybody in the room that wishes to testify this afternoon, please come on forward.
Hello.
Hi. Welcome.
Thank you.
We need your name for the record, and we're looking at about a, pardon me? Name and affiliation, and now I've got a little alarm here at 3 minutes, so.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is Lily Pothier. I work for the state of Alaska, but I'm here on a personal leave representing my own interests and what I believe to be actually a very, very important act of advocacy for the Earth. So, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge should not be utilized for oil and gas extraction. The national decline in oil production results from the fact that oil and gas are a finite resource, fundamentally. Once we have extracted all of the oil and all of the gas, there will be none. So it would make a lot of sense to invest in renewable sources of energy. And while the industry claims to be capable of responsible oil and gas development, they're not able to prevent disastrous accidents, such as spills, which have the potential to devastate and contaminate tracts of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Oil development on the coastal plain would forever change this critical wild habitat. And on this planet, we're starting to run out of places that are truly wild, places where the ecosystem has not been damaged or impacted by human development in any way. So, while I understand that the resource extraction has the potential to produce 10 to 11 billion barrels, that's the maximum that this field could produce, and that would result in a lot more damage than 2,000 acres, which is what's proposed for this lease. So I'm here to advocate for abstaining from extracting oil and gas in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I think it's a tragedy that would be inflicted upon a pristine ecosystem. Thank you.
Thank you very much. See if there are any questions from the committee. Thank you very much for your testimony, ma'am. Is there anyone else in the room that wishes to testify? Seeing no one, we will move to our LIO. We have, this is Adrian Titus in Fairbanks. Adrian?
Good afternoon, Rilla Akaluk. Welcome to Adrian Titus. I'm Akaluk. My English name is Adrian. I'm originally from Unalakleet. I am testifying today on behalf of myself in opposition of this bill. I oppose any development in Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. With the recent IPCC report coming out, we're seeing the need to reduce greenhouse gases and emissions from extractive industries. And with the Area 1002 being the last 5% of the North Slope that has not been explored on, I think it's time to leave that alone. Rural Alaska is, there are many, 33 communities that are seeing the impacts, coastal communities that are already seeing the impacts of climate change along with the rest of the state and the Arctic. It's our responsibility to move forward to looking into renewable energy resources that can sustain not only the Arctic, but help lead the way for the rest of the world to be able to leave a healthy and clean environment for generations to come. With that being said, there's also no immediate spill response on the North Slope. If there was to incur a oil spill, the closest Coast Guard station is located in Kodiak, and it would take days to respond. Also, dispersant chemicals are not proven to be able to clean up oil spills on the North Slope. The communities on the North Slope are already being impacted by oil and gas development, with the cancer clusters growing, autoimmune diseases impacting people that have lived there for generations. The polar bear dens are at threat on the coastal plain already because of climate change, and the porcupine caribou herd, which the Gwich'in people and the Inupiaq people of the North Slope rely on, will be impacted. That's their demming, their calving grounds up in Area 1002, and with climate change already impacting the herd because of the early mosquito blooms, they're needed to be left alone. I want to disagree with whoever said that a majority of the people in Alaska are pro-drilling. We're seeing the trend be pushed forward with false propaganda, and AFRC is speaking out only for their corporate gains. There are a lot of stakeholders that are in opposition to drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, but because of that suppression of dissent in the North Slope Borough, we see a lot of them not be able to speak out because of their job security being threatened by industry.
Thank you. Do you have any additional?
We're at a time now in the state where we're needing to make a change in how our economic balance is met. And we are not America's energy warehouse. We are not your backyard. So I do respectfully oppose any development in Area 1002 and the refuge. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Titus, for your testimony this afternoon. Don't see any questions from the committee. Thank you very much. Next, we have Lois Epstein with the Wilderness Society in Anchorage.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yep, loud and clear, Lois.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you to Chairman Birch and the committee for providing this opportunity for public testimony.
My name is Lois Epstein, and I am an Alaska licensed engineer with the Wilderness Society and the organization's Arctic Program Director. Since the Wilderness Society's beginnings in the 1930s, our scientists and other staff have worked in Alaska to protect the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge from development. We recognize it as a place with extraordinary wildlife, wilderness, and subsistence values, and as iconic as other American landscapes such as Yellowstone and Yosemite. Not all places in Alaska are alike, nor are all places appropriate for oil drilling and industrialization. Had the provision supporting drilling not been quietly attached to the 2017 Tax Act, where it needed only 51 votes to pass the Senate, the refuge still would be protected from development for future generations. Fortunately, earlier this month, California Representative Jared Hoffman introduced H.R. 5911 with over 100 co-sponsors in the House, a bill that would repeal the drilling provision of the 2017 Tax Act. As a technical analyst, I would like to refute several incorrect statements often made by Arctic Refuge drilling advocates. Our organization's comments on the draft environmental impact statement that will be submitted in, which will be submitted in March, argue that the draft needs to be significantly revised and reissued for public review because of its extensive deficiencies. First, the draft EIS does not include a reasonable range of alternatives. All the alternatives offered would result in similar development and impacts and production. Second, even though the 2017 Tax Act limits surface disturbances to 2,000 acres, the draft EIS excludes substantial acreage throughout the coastal plain that would be impacted, including gravel mines, ice roads, pipeline arrays, snow fences, raised structures, etc. In effect, the footprint of production and support will be much, much greater than 2,000 acres under BLM's interpretation of the law. Additionally, while well pad sizes have been reduced over the years, the rest of the industry's footprint and impact have remained relatively unchanged. Third, although the Trans-Alaska pipeline system currently is operating at less than its peak, pipelines always are designed and operated to carry less than peak flow. Oil production in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is not necessary to ensure that TAPS remains viable and economic for decades to come. Staff at Alaska DNR expect TAPS throughput to continue increasing through the late 2020s due to new discoveries on state lands and the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska that are now undergoing permitting, as well as the offshore Liberty development. Fourth, the job claims made by some are highly misleading. Unless the people who obtain jobs would otherwise be unemployed, the jobs resulting from Arctic Refuge oil development are not created or new jobs. Notably, the majority of oil and gas workers in Alaska reside out of state, and thus their wages largely are spent out of state. Fifth, Alaska's Arctic oil development has some real problems. One employee died this past year. There have been two blowouts attributed to thawing permafrost during the past 2 years, and Alaska's venting, flaring, and fugitive emissions requirements are well behind other state standards. Sixth, as information about the problems with potential seismic operations and oil drilling in the refuge has been made increasingly available to Alaskans, there has been growing opposition, non-native and native, to allowing any industrial activities on the coastal plain. The recent Senate poll showed over 44% of Alaskans opposed such drilling and would oppose this resolution. Last, on a personal level and as an Alaskan, I'm concerned the state will have a long-term black eye nationally and globally for unnecessarily destroying this iconic landscape. While some may argue that oil production on the coastal plain is not destruction, no one argues that there will not be permanent impacts that will transform this near pristine area. For these and other reasons, and on behalf of our membership in Alaska, I respectfully request that SJR 7 not be approved by this committee. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony this afternoon, Ms. Epstein. Yes, Senator Reinbold, question for you.
Lois, just a quick question. You stated something about the majority of all Alaskan oil workers are out of state. Can you source that data? Because when I've done research, it was between 70% and 90% have Alaskan hire. So just if you could get that to the committee, where you reference your source, that would be great. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. I'm looking at an economics report that we had a contractor help compile for us as part of our comments. And it says that in 60, the majority of wages are spent out of state, 64% in 2016 on page 3-235 of the draft EIS.
Great, thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you again for your testimony this afternoon, Ms. Epstein. Next, we have in Fairbanks, Fran Maurer, representing herself.
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for providing the opportunity to make comments. My
thank
name
you,
is
sir.
Fran Maurer. I'm a resident here in Fairbanks, and I'm speaking on my own behalf. I've been involved in conservation issues in Alaska for the last 48 years, and I'd like to point out a bit of history regarding how the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge was originally established. It took place, there was a campaign underway in the late 1950s, about the same time that statehood, the movement for statehood was underway. And there was a public land order, number 82, that President Roosevelt established in 1943 that withdrew the entire North Slope of Alaska for military purposes during World War II. All of the North Slope was off limits to the to any selection of lands by the new state of Alaska. A deal was struck between the Secretary of Interior and proponents for statehood that the Secretary under Dwight Eisenhower would lift the public land order 82 in the area between the existing petroleum reserve number 4 and the proposed Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And that paved the way for the state to select and obtain ownership of Prudhoe Bay and all the other satellite oil fields that are now in production and many that haven't been developed yet. The promise was made at the time that the Arctic Refuge would be established for its wildlife and wilderness values, which is part of the establishing order of the original Arctic National Wildlife Range. Now, what's happened in the since then is that the state of Alaska has aggressively pushed to try to get into the Arctic Refuge and develop oil in spite of this compromise that was struck at statehood. The American people are being unjustifiably impacted by the loss of this great wild landscape due to the interests of the state of Alaska. This is inappropriate. It's not American. And we don't see other states, such as Arizona, lobbying Congress to build a dam across the Grand Canyon that would flood a national park. And I just believe it's the height of greed that this state is trying to get into some of our nation's most treasured wild places and wildlife areas. We've had a great opportunity with Prudhoe Bay and all the billions of dollars that it has produced. And our leaders, both in the executive and legislative branches, in my opinion, have grossly squandered that money and not working towards renewable energy projects and alternative economic programs in this state, and continued to only focus on getting its economic benefits from oil. The time has come to turn away from drilling in the Arctic Refuge. We've got enormous problems with climate change already, and more reports are showing up almost by the week, showing that great reduction in putting carbon in the atmosphere is necessary to save the planet from cooking.
Thank you, Mr. Maurer.
I don't know when we will come to our senses on this, but I sure hope it's soon. I'm totally opposed to this resolution and urge you to vote against it. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Maurer. Let's see if there's any questions. I see none. Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Next, we have Sarah Maupin, ASRC member in Fairbanks.
Yes, I'm here. Thank you for letting me speak. Uvanga Sekanev, Aningarunga Utkalvigmi, Aka Ga Harriet Maupin, Apaga Raymond Maupin, Akaluga
Lena Simmons, Apalra Abe Simmons. My name is Sikaneth Maupin. I was born in Utqiagvik, formerly known as Barrow. My mother is Harriet Maupin. My father is Raymond Maupin. My grandmother is Lena Simmons, originally from Nooksit, the Kutpigmiu people. And my grandfather is Abe Simmons, Jr., originally from Utqiagvik. I am calling as an ASRC shareholder and someone that has been impacted by the NPRA and drilling in the Arctic for her entire life. I actually just got back from Nooksit with Alaska Community Action on Toxics, taking an air quality workshop. And some interesting information while visiting my community that is something observational that we already knew was happening. We just couldn't put scientific Western words to it. But we have had a study, one of the first by ACAT that was done. And so I want to read off some of the implications that have happened because of the drilling. And first to start with the NPRA, when we were told they were going to drill and give us jobs and economy, as many people have told us with the Arctic refugees going to happen, they continued to say that we would be safe, that we'd be taken care of, that we would thrive, that we would have a thriving economy. What's happened is the same thing that's happened all over Alaska. We make billions in revenue, but we don't see much of that money put into our actual school systems, into our communities. Many community members don't have clean water. Many of our community members do not have a job because there are no jobs in Nooksit and in these places. There are five residents that work on the slope right now from Nooksit out of 500. And so we, right now, they're currently trying to drill in the Tushookbook Lake, which is a sacred land for us that was promised not to be drilled in. So when we hear that the Arctic Refuge is only going to have a small, tiny impact, that it is only going to be in a contained area, that's not true. Maybe it's not politically correct, but the BIM or BLM have been liars, and they have promised many things that have been empty promises. And currently, when we try to speak out against further drilling and our homes being devastated and our people, we're ignored. And then we have our corporations who are supposed to represent us say that we are for drilling, more drilling, and we aren't. We have many shareholders as an ASRC shareholder who have spoken up and been ignored. We also have now ASRC board representatives starting to speak up because they are concerned about the health qualities and the air qualities implicated by the drilling. So some of the contaminants that have been put into our air is sulfur dioxide. There have been 2,184,980 pounds as of 2014 in the North Slope. PM2, particulate matter 10, 1,776,668 pounds. PM2.5 is 1,733,795 pounds. We've had VOCs, volatile organic compounds, in numbers of 1,343,440 pounds. And some of the most dangerous ones we've had is hexane, 4,402 pounds. And formaldehyde, 35,376 pounds.
Thank you, Ms.
Maupin. Some of the implications from these contaminants, the toxins being put into our air, snow, food, and animals, and, of course, our people, are loss of memory, lower logical memory, more severe allergic responses, reduced pulmonary function, asthma, lower birth weight, increased risk of premature birth, increased risk of stroke.
Thank you, Ms. Maupin. Can you conclude your comments?
Many of the residents in Nooksit have lost their ability to smell and taste. We have children that are medevaced monthly. One child, a baby, cannot produce red blood cells. We've had two children in a population of 500 that have developed leukemia.
Ms. Maupin?
We have had die of asthma. We have elders with asthma, middle age with asthma. We have cancer clusters in the 60s.
Ms. Maupin, can I get you to conclude your testimony, Ms. Maupin?
I'm sorry, what?
Can I get you to conclude your testimony?
Sure.
Okay.
So what I'm trying to say is that the Arctic Refuge, as people continue to say, is our economy and energy warehouse. This is not our warehouse. There are people dying because of the drilling that is happening. We have had BLM not do a responsible EIS, and I am in opposition of drilling in the Arctic Refuge, and I am appalled by some of the statements today that are blatant lies that this has been responsible, as there are thousands of oil spills in the Arctic. And I would like to conclude that the Inupiaq people are not all for, we are not a majority for drilling in the Arctic Refuge. So please stop killing our people in interest of your jobs in the Lower 48. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Maupin. We'll see if there's any committee questions. I don't see any, but thank you for your testimony this afternoon. Next, we have Chris Eichenlaub from Eagle River.
Hi, this is Chris Eichenlaub, for the record, from Eagle River. Can you hear me?
I sure can, loud and clear.
Okay, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and say SGR-7 is definitely, I am for it. Because, you know, here's the deal. I mean, I've been listening to everybody else testify a little bit here. And, you know, if we went by all the Chicken Littles, you know, the North Slope would have never been developed. You know, everybody told us that the caribou would die, and, you know, and now we see that they're flourishing more than they were before. And we probably have the best regulations on the planet for regulating how we do our business through our resource development is very responsible. And we have many watchdog groups that, I mean, these guys can't even throw a cup of coffee on the ground that, you know, is considered a contaminant. So, I mean, we have so much, I'm watching people leave the state, young people that are with the oil industry that are going to the Dakotas and Texas and stuff because they can't get oil jobs here. And this is, you know, this is our lifeline in our state. I mean, basically we're developing our resources for the maximum value to the people. And that's, you know, part of our constitution. So, you know, if we're doing it in a responsible manner, I'm all for it. And, you know, the sooner the better. You know, if we could streamline this, it would even be much better, because years ago we tried to get, you know, that opened up, and it would, you know, everybody was like, well, it's going to take 15 years. It's going to take 15 years. Well, you know, that was 15, 20 years ago. It would already be flowing now if we would have, you know, stepped on the gas pedal a little bit instead of slammed on the brakes. So that's my testimony. I'm all for it. Drill, baby, drill. Anybody got any questions for me?
Thank you for your testimony this afternoon, Mr. Eichenlaub. Are there any questions? Seeing none from the committee, thank you, sir, for your testimony this afternoon. Next, we have Vicki Jo Kennedy from Kodiak.
Yeah, hi there. I'm definitely not in favor of drilling in ANWR. And after listening to Sarah Maupin, I don't know how anybody, not on our hill or not even on that big hill in D.C., because I was there in 2017 when they passed that ANWR would be done. All three of our congressional delegation were in joy. They were elated because it had finally passed up there. Now, we can't do it. We just can't. You listen to Sarah. We can't keep raping this state, and that's what we're doing. We're putting missiles everywhere, and we're drilling everywhere. The reason the people are leaving the state for oil jobs is because they stopped paying that much for oil. And if that man would do his homework, he would know that. And they're closing down in North Dakota, too. And that other man that called, he's right about developing natural resources. We've got plenty of it in this state. We don't have to keep using fossil fuels. We're not making any money from it anyway. I think the $1.6 billion deficit will tell us that. Everything's going to be cut. Everything. And it's getting to ANWR that's going to be the problem. Ms. Maupin was right. It's the roads. It's everything that's got to get in there to get it done. We just can't do it. Let's leave something unraped in this state. And besides the Pebble Mine, this is the biggest one we've got going. So I beg you not to endorse this and not pass it. I thank you for listening to me, and I'll see you in a day or two. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony this afternoon, Ms. Kennedy. See if there's no questions from the committee. Thank you. Next, we have Princess Lukaj from Fairbanks.
Hi, can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay, Shojrita Jayoji, Netaiguchen Ikli, Shiachanai Catherine, Stephen Peter, Oji Gaba Kwa, Netaiguchen Ikli. My name is Princess Dajrai Johnson. My legal name is Lukai. And my grandparents are the late Catherine and Stephen Peter from Arctic Village. And I am calling in opposition of this resolution. It's really obvious to me that the public opinion on this issue has changed considerably. According to a recent Senate online poll, it showed that 44.5% of the respondents opposed oil and gas lease sales in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And even though the survey response was not the largest response of all Alaskans, you know, we just have to question, you know, for those that didn't have internet access or who didn't know about it, what the response would be. But I would not call it, I think it's, not true to say that the majority of Alaskans are in support of this anymore. And as an Netsaiguchin person, you know, I constantly hear people saying, oh, you know, this has nothing to do with the Gwich'in. It's not, you know, technically it's not by them. It's like not their land. But it's ridiculous because these are man-made borders around this, you know, what they call the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. But still, our communities, our 15 communities between Alaska and Canada, are dependent upon that porcupine caribou herd for our food security. And, you know, if we look at the bigger picture of climate change, which, you know, we should all be, I think, alarmed by Dunleavy's position on this to get rid of our climate change commission, to make cuts to our budget that really is, it's just, it's horrifying to me as an Alaskan, let alone somebody who is a Netsaiguchin person, to look at the possible implications of this budget. But like what others are saying right now, we need to wake up and look at the science, the found science on climate change, and look at the bigger picture that we need to be transitioning off the fossil fuels. And in my, you know, humble opinion, it is a waste of our time to be passing resolutions like this when really we need to be going in an innovative and a different direction. Our state's in a lot of trouble, and I am just hopeful because there's so many people that are motivated right now and making the phone calls into all of you who are making these decisions. And I would just, you know, say resoundly, do not pass this resolution. This is a waste of our time and energy. We need to be going in a different direction right now. Masik Cho for listening.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Lakai. Let's see, was there no questions from the committee. Thanks again for your testimony this afternoon. Next, we have Misty Nicoli from Fairbanks.
Hi, this is Misty Nicoli from Fairbanks. I'm calling on behalf of myself. As an Alaskan, I disagree with our state, which is already in economic peril, opening up the refuge or any other part Alaska area to become the welfare system to the federal government. For the first 7 years of development, opening up a rig, Alaska won't even see economic benefit. Alaska pays about $2 billion per year in subsidies to oil companies. To sum it up, we're paying out our limited Alaska funds to the federal government and corporate interests for their benefit at Alaska's expense. And that's not a balanced checkbook. In this current economic time for our state, we cannot be throwing away our resources to outside interests. Additionally, if we look at the other economic benefits we're putting in jeopardy, we're looking at the resources, the natural resources that are there. So the animal life that supports the people from that area and the animal life that come from, you know, South America all the way to Alaska and then go back. We're putting that into peril and jeopardy. And as other people have already said, the health problems that come along with development are, it's too great of a human cost. So don't open up Alaska so that, you know, put us at risk so that we could fill other people's pocketbooks. That's about what I have to say.
Thank you, Ms. Nikolai. Let's see if there's no questions from the committee members. Thank you very much for your testimony this afternoon. Next, we have Rosemary Athangarak from Nuiqsut. I apologize on the last name.
Rosemary Athangarak.
That's what I thought. Please proceed, ma'am. Thank you for being here this afternoon.
I wanted to testify. I've learned a lot living in the village of Nuiqsut and becoming surrounded with the oil and gas development. I really had hoped that the vision of protecting an area along the Arctic coast not to be open for oil and gas development would be a vision that was maintained and given the hopes of having an area that we could go to and have a more traditional way of life than trying to hunt and harvest amongst the oil fields. The risk for our community has caused tons of emissions that are related to the oil and gas development process. Every year, these tons of emissions are being emitted. The health of our people are important. They are not a sacrifice zone for the oil and gas development process. The area that is being proposed for oil and gas development has been protected and restricted from the impacts of the changes that we are suffering through living amongst the many thousand wells that are surrounding our community. Having an area where our caribou can go to the coast and have important renewal and have hopes to return to the many communities that are depending upon these important vital foods that feed our generations and the generations to come are very important. Mm-hmm. Our community has watched the changes to migrations into our area, and the worry that we have is the additional impacts to other communities around us. The importance of the safety of our food source has not been demonstrated with the activities that are there. There are words on paper that say that things should be protected, but there is no enforcement. The tons of emissions from the process of flaring of gas cause impacts to our community with the inversion that happened related to the oil and gas development. These tremendous amounts of tons of emissions that befall upon the air that our community uses to live and survive, as well as the many animals that we depend upon to feed our families, are also exposed to these tons of emissions. They cause a tremendous amount of health effects that are well demonstrated in various documents that talk about the emissions and the impacts to human health. These important emissions are not well documented because it's only on industry self-reporting, but the concerns extend beyond the here and now because of the accumulation into the snowpack and into the fish and into the renewal of the foods that we depend upon. They migrate to many different areas, and they should be allowed to return to these areas that are vital to every continent. The concentration of the birds that return to the Arctic are not found in other Arctic continents and communities as they are in the North Slope. This vitality is beyond understanding. But when you watch the tremendous erosion that is happening with the climate change and the warming of temperatures, and you see an eagle's nest upon the cliffside, and the tremendous rains that are happening in July that are not normal for this time of year and in this area, you see the erosion cause the destruction of the nest of the eagle on the cliffside. I do not know when that baby eagle fell onto the riverbank if it returned to the lower 48, but this vitality is the renewal of our nation.
Thank you.
This
Thank you for.
We should continue into the future.
Thank you for your testimony, Rosemary. Do you have any concluding comments?
The cost of oil and gas development should not cost the health of the people who live where oil and gas development is going to occur.
Thank you. Thank you, Rosemary. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Next we have John Sonnen from Douglas. Mr. Sonnen?
Well, how be you guys? Hi, John Sonnen from over here on the other side of the pond. Just having to fall on this community meeting by accident, and I'm so grateful I did.
We are too. Proceed, please.
The last remarks, full and wholeheartedly. It's not just the species and the ecological degradation that more carbon that took millions, hundreds of millions of years to get settled into our crust and out of our atmosphere, back up there in just a few minutes geologically. We have got to keep ANWR as much as can be out of the hands of oil companies, especially some of the mindless oil companies that will just purge it until they can't make any money off of it. And we are stuck on this cycle, so I can't put all the blame on them, but you guys as leaders should be moving us away, finding alternatives for our economy and for our health. We cannot withstand continued respiratory degradation, not just for breathing. I'm sorry. It's all the other toxins that we're throwing up into the atmosphere, dumping into our water supplies, and any more development of what is currently pristine wilderness is just going to diminish what is already being diminished in the end, I guess. So I'm not going to go on forever, but I'm not going to, because you guys can take some more comments. But I'm adamantly opposed to leasing any property in the ANWR reservation or wilderness region. So please, if you're going to sell any leases, make them so expensive that they can't be bought for a profit. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Sonnen. I don't see any questions here. Thank you for your testimony, sir. See, at this point, we'll see if there's anyone else in the room that would like to testify. Oh, yeah, please come forward, your name and affiliation for the record, and we'll have 3 minutes for your testimony.
Great, thank you. My name is Anna Sorensen. I'm representing the Northern Alaska Environmental Center. We're based in Fairbanks. We're a conservation organization that's been around since 1971. The resolution and the industry representatives that have spoken have repeated several myths that have been presented as facts, and we would like to correct the record a little bit on some of that information. The first being that the Bureau of Land Management, this has been said in testimony that's been given today, is hosting a public meeting in Anchorage today to gather input on a draft environmental impact statement focusing strictly on limited oil and gas leasing program in the non-wilderness portion of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. to correct that, the fact is that the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is approximately 1.5 million acres in entirety. It is undeveloped land. There are no roads, no visitor centers, very little infrastructure of any kind, and it is integral to the part of an intact ecosystem of the refuge. And its critical ecological link between the Brooks Range and the Beaufort Sea. It is a great example of wilderness, a greater example of wilderness than most any other land in the United States or the world. Another myth that has been presented today is that in 1980, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, commonly known as ANILCA, that Congress identified the coastal plain for its potential for oil and gas resources. ANILCA expanded the refuge while setting aside 1.5 million acres for potential drilling. The fact, on the other side of that myth, is that the coastal plain was protected by President Eisenhower in 1960 as part of the 8.9 million acre Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, quote, for the purpose of preserving unique wildlife, wilderness, and recreation values. In 1980, ANILCA also authorized an, quote, assessment of the fish and wildlife resources of the coastal plain, end quote, including to, and starting the quote again, analyze the potential impacts of oil and gas exploration, development, and production on such wildlife and habitats. ANILCA has explicitly prohibited oil and gas development at that time in Section 1003, which says production of oil and gas from the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is prohibited and no leasing or other development leading to production of oil and gas from the range shall be undertaken until authorized by an act of Congress. Another myth that has been presented is that by law the footprint of production and supporting facilities will be limited to no more than 2,000 surface acres at any given time, including land holdings, and that this is equivalent to only 0.01% of the refuge's 19.3 million acres.
Thank you, Ms. Sorensen. Could you, you have any concluding comments? Or?
Yeah, the last point I'd like to make is that the Senate poll that was recently done showed that 55% to 44% of the roughly 7,400 people who took the poll were in favor of drilling in the Arctic Refuge. And I realize that this is a majority, however, it is quite slim, and the two-thirds number that was represented earlier in testimony has been shrinking consistently over time, and that Alaskans are more and more becoming opposed to drilling in the Arctic Refuge.
Great. Thank you for your testimony this afternoon.
Thank you for your time.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Keel, or Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Sorensen, you had, I think, said something about the 2,000-acre disturbance area, and I had pushed on that a little bit. I didn't quite understand your comment about the 2,000 acres. What is it that the committee's misunderstanding about that?
You're referring to the I apologize, let me go back to my comment here about the 2,000 acres that you've mentioned. Well, they had presented a in testimony they had said that it was no more than 2,000 acres at any given time, and that was only a very small portion of the Arctic Refuge. But again, that calculation is somewhat false, and I'm happy to give you the thinking on that and what our estimation of that footprint would be. I'm happy to email you that information later.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Question? You bet. Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony this afternoon. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify? Okay, we have no one else online, and with that, at this point, we will close public testimony on SJR 7. I would note that, as I mentioned earlier and discussed with everyone, it would be my intent to move this afternoon, if it's the will of the committee, due to the March 13th deadline for receiving testimony. And at this point, Mr. Vice Chair, I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman. May I just make a comment about this?
Oh, please do.
Mr. Chairman, SCR 7 represents the sixth resolution that I will have the opportunity to vote yes on. Mm-hmm. In addition, I spoke to two of the public scoping meetings that were held by the Department of Interior. Now, my only criticism of this resolution is that it only speaks about revenue and the environment. It doesn't speak to the positive impact on Alaska's people that resource development represents. So, Mr. Chairman, I do want to call to your attention an article that was published in the Journal of American Medical Association less than a year ago, last May. It was published, or the research that was published relates to life expectancy and the change in life expectancy from 1980 to 2014. In other words, were people living longer or not across the United States? And this was by county, Mr. Chairman. And so they asked that question, and it was very interesting results. I'm going to share those results in a minute. But the first question, of course, a lot of skeptical people would ask was, well, this was probably paid for by the oil companies. Well, in fact, it wasn't. The affiliations of the researchers were the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation, University of Washington, Seattle, and the Department of Public Health, Rotterdam, Netherlands. These folks had nothing to do with oil. But, Mr. Chairman, the results are exemplified in a map that is in the study. Now, I realize you can't see the details of this, but I'll give you a clue. The red areas mark places where life expectancy decreased. You see very few of those. The places that are marked in the darkest blue had the highest increase in life expectancy. Now, Alaska is down here next to Hawaii in its usual wrong location. But you can see, Mr. Chairman, that the North Slope, Northwest Arctic Burrow, parts of the Aleutians down in southeast had the highest life expectancy increase, 8 to 13 year increase in life expectancy over the years from 1980 to 2014. So what was happening in Alaska during those times? Taps came online. The North Slope began to produce oil. In addition, Red Dog Mine over by Kotzebue, Northwest Arctic Burrow, began working, producing. These created jobs. These jobs brought increased income. They brought access to health care, education, all of those assets, Mr. Chairman. As it turns out, the researchers looked at what were the factors that contribute to the change in life expectancy. And in fact, those criteria accounted for 82% of the impact causing the increase in life expectancy. Mr. Chairman, this is very concrete, objective, unsolicited documentation that resource development is good for Alaskans' health. I share the concern for our environment, Mr. Chairman. I'm a lifelong Alaskan, as are you. Mr. Chairman, the greatest threat to the environment is poverty. And that's what we're trying to overcome in our state, bringing wealth to Alaskans, bringing access to clean water, health care, education, jobs, and income. So, Mr. Chairman, I am going to be quite pleased to vote yes on SJR 7. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Well said. Any other comments, discussion?
Sure.
Senator Kawasaki?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the opportunity and appreciate this coming forward. I did want to make a couple comments about a couple of the other whereases. The first one on page 3, I'll just read it. It says, safe and responsible oil and gas exploration development over the last 50 years without adverse effects on the environment. When we're putting out definitive policy, I just wanted to say that I don't know that that's 100% true, maybe to a varying degree. I just wanted to put that on the record. The other question I had, the other comment is a couple whereases below, because somebody did testify. A couple of people did testify from Nuiqsut on the North Slope Borough. It seems to assert that the residents of the borough and the population of whom are predominantly Inupiat are supportive of development, and I just don't know if that's 100% true. And then finally, I just wanted to say that I can't tell from this resolution if we are endorsing a specific proposal moving forward. I'm always uncomfortable saying that we're going to support something that is several hundred pages that I personally haven't had a chance to read, and I don't know if there's other members here who have. And if we are supporting a particular alternative in this So that's just, I think that's a question for you, Mr. Chairman. If we're supporting a specific alternative or not, one of the alternatives is that there's not, or there's no action, and then there's varying degrees of action or activity that are in this draft document. So I guess that's a question for you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. Mr. Fulton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, Trevor Fulton, Senate Resources Committee. I'll respond to your last question first, Senator Kawasaki, as to whether or not the resolution was endorsing a particular action alternative. There were four action alternatives identified in the draft EIS, as you noted, one of which was the no action alternative, the other three being excuse me. The other three being continually more restrictive than the previous, if that makes sense. And we specifically did not want to endorse any one of those alternatives. Instead, we are endorsing and urging the Department of Interior to continue with this important process. This is the first step in a long regulatory process, and it's an important step. And we're encouraging progress on the leasing program in general instead of one of those specific alternatives.
Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes your questions.
Yes.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may respond to one other question that Senator Kawasaki that I didn't get to answer. And that was a question about the whereas that spoke specifically to support from the North Slope Borough residents. And again, I apologize, this I don't believe ended up in your packet, but I do have a resolution passed September 8th, 2017. So I would note it's the most current resolution, but it's not directly speaking to this resolution before you, SJR 7. But it is fairly recent, and it's from the Voice of the Arctic Inupiat, which consists of, and this is a long list, so you'll have to bear with me here, but it's Arctic Slope Native Association, City of Anaktuvik Pass, City of Point Hope, Native Village of Aktivsuk, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, City of Wainwright, Native Village of Point Lay, and there's several more that I'm going to jump through just to get to the North Slope Borough, which was the one that you specifically asked about. So we do have a resolution. Supporting ANWR development is actually the title of the resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Fulton. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Another question for you or for your staff. I appreciated the list of past ANWR-related resolutions, and I snuck a peek at three or four of them here, and I noticed a couple of things that were pretty consistently in the ones I glanced at. That I'm not seeing in this resolution. I just wondered if you could talk about why or if you'd be amenable to adding them. In the past, they've pretty consistently called for using some of the revenues for the development of renewable and alternative energy resources in the state, and for, that called for exploration, development, and production activity to be conducted in a manner that protects the environment and the population levels of the porcupine caribou herd. And then that uses the state's workforce to the maximum extent possible. And so those three things, I think, were all sort of touched on by public commenters. Could you talk about if there's a particular reason they're not present in this resolution, and would the chairman or the sponsor be amenable to adding those?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, the first point you brought up there, actually, if you could reiterate those very briefly. I'll respond to them one at a time.
Alternative energy in the state?
Yes. Okay, the alternative energy question, that would very much be outside of the scope of the audience that we're aiming this resolution toward. Previous resolutions had been addressed towards Congress. This resolution is direct towards the executive branch, specifically the Department of the Interior. And it would certainly be outside of the scope of the draft EIS, which this ultimately serves as a comment on.
Thank you.
And then, Mr. Chairman, again with the...
We're kind of running out of time. Go ahead.
So porcupine caribou herd and using the state's workforce. Those were the other two.
Can we... let's see. I think we'll get back to you on that. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Briefly, I'm gonna just say it like the only way I know how to say it, and I've got to really say it fast. I respect everybody's opinion, pro and con. But the fact of the matter remains, we don't have a federal treasury, and we can't print money. So with that, where am I going with that? I want to see this state get to renewables as fast as we can get to renewables, but we've got to be able to have a cash stream to be able to pay for those renewables, whether it's a Sousit and a dam, whether it's a wind farm, or whether it's a combination wind farm, LNG project, propane project in rural Alaska. 64 cents a kilowatt hour in rural Alaska with PCE. That's a lot of money. I want to work together as with my counterparts in the Senate to lower our energy costs across the state. But we need revenue to do it. And the last thing I want to say is that 7 trillion cubic feet of gas over there in the Point Thompson area, that's almost fuel-grade quality gas. And the quicker that we can get that online, the quicker we can lower our carbon footprint in Alaska. I'll be supporting this resolution. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Vice Chair, I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move the SDR 7 version M out of committee with individual recommendations and a zero fiscal note. Thank
you. Is there any objection? Seeing none, SDR moves out of committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Back from recess, and in closing, I would add that the next committee meeting will be held at 3:30 p.m. Wednesday, February 27th, when we'll take up SB 43 to extend the Big Game Commercial Services Board. It will be the second hearing in SB 43, so if you have any amendments, please get them to our committee aide 24 hours prior to Wednesday's hearing. With that, this meeting is adjourned at 5:03 p.m.